I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Many things influence the way we experience the urban environment, the history of the place, certainly its form, others who share the space with us, even the sounds and smells. Today, our guests are shaping urban environments in their own ways. Rick Kembler and Kathleen Norris are remaking a history-laden neighborhood in downtown Cincinnati called Over the Rhine and bringing new life to its streets with shops, restaurants, and new residents. Mark Shepherd, an architect teaching architecture and media studies at the University at Buffalo, is exploring the impact of sound, specifically collaborative sounds, on the way we experience cities. We'll talk to Rick Kembler, Kathleen Norris, and Mark Shepherd about shaping cities today, right after the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Rick Kembler is a partner in North Point Group, a primary developer in Cincinnati's Over the Rhine neighborhood on the edge of downtown. Rick has more than 25 years' experience in commercial and residential real estate, construction, and development. Kathleen Norris is retail leasing consultant for the Gateway Quarter, the focus of Rick's development in Over the Rhine, where she's developing the concept for a new retail destination for Cincinnati. Kathleen is principal with her own firm, Kathleen Norris & Associates. Rick, describe the Over the Rhine neighborhood in Cincinnati.
The Over the Rhine neighborhood is it's been labeled the largest collection of Italianate architecture remaining in the country. It at one time housed approximately 40-some thousand residents, and currently I believe there are under 5,000 residing within Over the Rhine. It's a fairly substantial neighborhood, maybe 70 acres or so of property, if not larger.
And it's just it just borders on downtown. In fact, I would call it downtown, but I don't think the people of Cincinnati believe it's downtown, do they?
Well, for a long time, many people in downtown Cincinnati didn't want it to be a part of Cincinnati.
And why not?
It was a neighborhood that became the deposit area for social service agencies, for a lot of Section 8 housing product, and it was viewed as a second class or third class citizen to the Central Business District.
So what in the world made you as a developer decide that you would take a chance on Over the Rhine?
The important component here, Carol, was that the corporate community of Cincinnati banded together to form the Cincinnati Center City Development Corporation, otherwise known as 3CDC. And 3CDC identified Over the Rhine as an important component of re-energizing the downtown. And 3CDC recognized that Over the Rhine was really part of downtown, and they were thus willing to provide the patient capital that developers need in a situation such as this to really succeed. Traditional development financing just doesn't work in this situation. A number of developers had been trying for 20 or 25 years to make a difference in Over the Rhine, and doing it one building at a time did not provide the energy that was really needed to change the neighborhood.
How did they fund this patient capital? Was it out of their foundations, their corporate giving? Did they take? Did they leave it as an investment on their books? How did they do it?
You know, I have to honestly tell you that I don't know exactly how it shows on their books. I presume that for the most part it came from their foundations, Procter & Gamble, Macy's, Western Southern Life Insurance, Scripps, Fifth Third Bank, and others all stepped up to the table and provided patient capital as well as new market tax credits to be used in this endeavor.
This may seem really wonky, but can you describe simply how new market tax credits work?
I'll try. It's a federal program. And 3CDC was allocated $50 million of New Market Tax Credit money. So there, as I understand it, are $50 million of credits available to corporations that commit to buy those credits and put that money to work. There's very restrictive covenants on how the money can be used. And they earn they charge an interest rate of 2% for the money, and then they receive a dollar-for-dollar tax credit over a seven-year period of time. So if you're, as an example, Procter & Gamble, and you purchase $1 million worth of credits, you receive federal tax credits of $1 million, 1/7 a year for 7 years, and you earn an additional 2% yield on your money that is lent to a developer like ourselves, and we then are able to deploy those dollars into commercial investments. So the New Market Tax Credits are the funds that are used to renovate the first floor storefronts of the buildings that we've acquired.
Kathleen, you've rebranded a portion of Over the Rhine, the portion really closest to downtown. So tell me about the thinking behind the rebrand of Gateway Quarter and its magnitude.
As Rick said, the Over the Rhine area was one that has been very challenged in Cincinnati in the last 20 to 30 years. And the name Over the Rhine had come to mean nothing good. We didn't see that anymore in this city as an area of wonderful historic architecture. We didn't see it as the place where the city was founded. We saw it as the worst neighborhood in town. So when we wanted to relaunch new condominiums and new businesses down there, we put a lot of time into thinking about whether Over the Rhine gave us anything useful in that effort. And we knew that because it's such an important historic neighborhood, we couldn't walk away from that name, but we thought that we needed to create something within it that had a different connotation. And there, we had already had a building down there, the Gateway Building, which was the first piece of new construction in the neighborhood in decades. And so we took the first part of that name, Gateway, and we wanted a second piece that had some emotive value, and we thought quarter means something to people. When you hear quarter, rightly or wrongly, it starts a story in your head. You think Latin quarter, you think French quarter. So we thought that word had some positive value for us. So we paired up Gateway and quarter, and we then went within that and gave it a nickname, and we're calling it the Q.
I like the way you've thought about this. You've also, to carry through the branding or the rename there, you've created a center where all the developers working now in Gateway Quarter can show their product as, so the consumer, if you will, or the potential buyer or renter doesn't have to thread through the various projects individually, but instead can come to one place and see everything that's available. How important has that been to you?
I think it's been tremendously important, and really a lot of the credit goes to Rick. When we started on the retail side, it was my concept that we were going to build this like a shopping mall. We were going to choose the businesses that fit within our concept, and we were going to select our merchants rather than simply saying, first guy through the door with a rent check in his hand gets the space. So then when we went to the residential side, Rick said that he thought that it was crucial that we be selling all the spaces together. So we have 100 new condominiums down there built by 4 different development teams. But as a buyer, you don't care. You just want a house. So when you come down there, our sales team works for all those 4 developers and tries to determine what your interest is, what your style is, what your price point is, and then we'll show you anything by any of those developers that we think might be appealing to you.
Now, Rick talked about Over the Rhine being a place for social services, Section 8 housing. What's happened to all of that?
Well, as you know, in 2001, I think, the Section 8 housing system changed dramatically. And that was the first turning point for Over the Rhine. When they went to a voucher system, a lot of the people who had been living down there chose to move to another neighborhood. So that depleted the population of Over the Rhine even further. And with social service agencies, we certainly in the last couple of decades have seen a burgeoning of those. And certainly they meet a genuine need, but we might be a little overpopulated with them now. And there is a process where some of them are merging, where some of them are looking to what they do best and divesting services that might be better performed by other agencies, and where everybody is trying to figure out how to make this the most successful, genuinely mixed neighborhood in town.
Rick, what makes it worth it to you as a developer to work in a neighborhood like this one where there are social services and low-income residents? I know that there were at least perceptions of crime problems, if not crime problems themselves. I mean, that's a whole layer of complexity that must be very frustrating to encounter as a developer. What makes it worth it?
Well, you're right, Carol. It's a different animal. What makes it worth it for me is the importance that it has, in my opinion, to the city of Cincinnati and to the region as a whole. I believe that you have to have a strong core in order to succeed as a city and as a region. And for too long, we've avoided that, as have many second-tier cities, and the suburban development has continued. And quite frankly, I've made a lot of money on suburban development, so I like it very much. But we have to have a strong core, and I made a decision to dedicate a portion of my time to this objective, to try to bring some expertise to the team and try to make a difference. And it sounds altruistic, but I just think it's important, and it's incredibly rewarding. It's a lot more enjoyable, certainly not more financially beneficial, but more personally beneficial and enjoyable.
Why? What makes it enjoyable, Rick?
Saving the properties, saving the architecture, re-energizing the downtown, creating an urban atmosphere, an exciting urban atmosphere, where young, old, affluent, poor, people of color, people of different alternative lifestyles all mesh together is just an exciting venue. And I think the key to the success of our city over the long term is to make it an attraction point.
Kathleen, when we were together visiting some of the properties, which really are stunning, I kept trying to calculate how I could make a living in Cincinnati. If you take off your sales hat for a minute, I know that's really hard to do. Is momentum now underway in Gateway Quarter?
I think momentum is underway. Whether momentum is unstoppable is maybe the more important question, and I don't think we're quite there yet. But certainly the magic elixir in this deal has been 3CDC and the fact that they have allowed us to move past incrementalism. But 3CDC is now doing entire blocks. And as we get a few more of those blocks under our belt and we get a few more merchants in there with good destination businesses and we get more residents down there, then I think the momentum will become unstoppable. I think we're close, but I don't think we're quite there yet.
Let's talk about the retail side of this, which I think for many communities that are redeveloping has been the toughest. That's the toughest nut to crack. You can get the residents back, but the retail, creating the, you know, the first floor energy and activity has been very hard. Kathleen, you seem to be a particularly imaginative leasing agent, and I want to know what your approach to getting those first merchants and those first restaurateurs into the district has been, and what your strategy is. I mean, what is it about those people, those businesses that you believe will attract then others?
We worked on a strategy first, and you used that word, and I think that's really the one of the keys to it. We spent a lot of time figuring out what we thought would make this neighborhood a destination retail location, what kind of businesses we needed to do that. And we started with one concept, and by the time we were done, that concept was still there as a piece, but it was not the concept that we finished with. We decided that since this is a center of historic architecture, since it is on city fringe, CBD fringe, since it is going to be new condo livings that we were living spaces that we were going to focus on contemporary urban style and design as our theme. So then we went after businesses that, by a very loose definition, would fit within that concept. We said furniture stores, home accessories, cool clothes, great restaurants, maybe a cigar store, a bookstore, just places that spoke to what it's like to live in a city. And we wanted to create a very walkable neighborhood because we have the opportunity to do that because it is so dense. So that was our the background or the backstory to this. And then I made a list of businesses that in the first phase, I made a list of businesses that I thought might play, and I went and I asked them. I said, in the best of all possible worlds, would you be interested in doing this? And we got a list of businesses that said they would, all things being equal. Well, that kind of gave us the momentum to get started. Then I went back to them and said, okay, now it is the real world. I've got spaces. What would it take to get you down here? And it took a lot of talking, and it took a lot of selling the dream. It took a lot of showing them the neighborhood. Our first business, I got thrown out of their store. There was a business with an existing store that was looking for space to expand. I got thrown out of the store the first three times I went in there. But gradually, we just kept calling on them. We kept surrounding them, if you will. We took them on tours. We talked about what it was going to look like. We talked about how the character of the neighborhood was changing. And we just probably sealed the deal by showing them absolutely gorgeous spaces.
Is there a sense of the conversation that has to begin taking place? I mean, I want to go back to this question of momentum. What I heard you say, Kathleen, was that the onesies, twosies are fine, but 3CDC made it possible to do entire blocks. And so that's part of the way you create momentum. And then you began looking for the right kinds of tenants and making sure that you had them first. What else is part of that momentum formula?
Tough question. I think the residents are an important part of the momentum formula. I think safety is a part of the momentum formula. I think that once you get some merchants in there, actually our current merchants are our best salespeople for future merchants because they will talk about the kind of business they're doing, which in every case is better than they thought they'd do. They will talk about how pleasant the people in the neighborhood are, which was to some extent a surprise to them. They will talk about the fact that the safety issues haven't really been issues for them. They're not foolish. They're not just being Pollyannas. They're realistic about the obstacles, such as they are, that they face. But they're pretty much putting all those obstacles in the basket of, well, this is what you'd have to be dealing with in any place you started a new business. They're not saying, gee, Over the Rhine is so much more difficult than someplace else, and we had this, that, and the other thing. They're actually saying the reverse. Over the Rhine is no more difficult than any place else. So they've been a help. And I think we just have to keep on stepping.
And you have to market. I mean, first and foremost, it has to be safe. And then you have to keep the marketing energy behind it. You've got to drive traffic. You've got to drive publicity. You've got to continue on a daily basis to get the word out because one of the challenges we've had is we don't have a big marketing budget. It's a lot of shoe leather and one-off kind of opportunities to sell what we're doing to some disbelieving populace. And so you've just got to keep on keeping on at doing that. and hope and a little good fortune. You know, you need a few breaks.
And you're also building now a performing arts school, what, K through 12?
Cincinnati will have the only K through 12 performing arts school in the United States. We have had a school for the creative and performing arts for many years, and our music hall, our symphony hall, is just on the boundary of the Gateway Quarter. It's one block to the west of where we are. And Eric Kunzel, one of our maestros, he runs the Cincinnati Pops, had the idea that the School for Creative and Performing Arts should be closer to music hall so that the kids would have an opportunity to interact with the professionals. So the Cincinnati Public School System has acquired a plot of land, and they broke ground 2 weeks ago, and we're going to be open, up and running by the 2009 school year.
Well, I love what you're doing in Gateway Quarter at Over the Rhine in Cincinnati, and I wish you much good luck. Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you
very much.
Rick Kembler and Kathleen Norris are leading the development of the Gateway Quarter in downtown Cincinnati's Over the Rhine neighborhood. The latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development comes to us from Planetizen assistant editor, Nate Berg.
New neighbors might mean more than just some fresh faces in the neighborhood. They could also mean an appetite for land that will take up twice the amount of space as longtime residents. A paper published in the journal Urban Studies found that as people move into urban areas, they take up twice the amount of space as existing residents. University of Minnesota environmental engineering professor Julian Marshall was examining census data for cities with growth rates of 10% or more for the past 50 years and was surprised to see the correlation between newer residents and larger amounts of land used. Armed with this data, cities may be able to gain the political leverage to move away from the pattern of sprawl development. And in Queens, New York, where parking is a high-priced commodity, the city planning department is pushing a plan to help reduce the amount of land lost to property owners who pave over their front yards to create parking spaces. The Queens Chronicle reports that the city has introduced a zoning change that would require all new construction to maintain a minimum amount of planting space in front yards. Proponents hope the plan will meet approval from community boards, which have 60 days to comment. And though some say parking is more important than a couple square feet of lawn, proponents are citing the environmental benefit of allowing stormwater to seep back into the ground rather than drain from paved parking spaces into paved gutters and city sewers. And finally, in San Francisco, cyclists and bike advocates recently celebrated the 15th anniversary of the group bike ride known as Critical Mass. The San Francisco Chronicle reports that the monthly bike ride slash political statement slash exercise in civil disobedience has grown from a relatively small action involving only 4 dozen people to a world-renowned event that brings thousands of cyclists out onto the city's streets. The loosely organized event has no specific leader and operates mainly at the whim of whoever ends up in the front of the pack, but the message of the bikers has been honed over the years as one calling for increased sensitivity to the varied uses of the road, and to move beyond the outdated assumption that streets are just for cars. And though the event has had its share of ugly run-ins between overzealous cyclists and angry motorists, San Francisco's critical mass has been able not only to sustain itself, but also to grow in popularity and spread across the world. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor for Planetizen.com. After a short break, we'll hear sounds from the Tactical Sound Garden and talk with Mark Shepard from the University at Buffalo about their impact on the way we experience and contribute to cities. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Chamber Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis and the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Assistant Professor Mark Shepard holds a joint appointment in the Departments of Architecture and Media Study at the University at Buffalo. His work draws on architecture, film, and new media in addressing new social spaces and signifying structures of contemporary network cultures. His research focuses on the implications of mobile and pervasive computing for architecture and urbanism. His work has been exhibited and screened at museums, galleries, and festivals in the U.S. and abroad. Are there, in fact, Mark, new social spaces?
Well, yes, I would say there are. In particular, if one looks at the way that mobile phones, for example, are used in public space today, what we're finding is ways of using them are, in fact, producing new types of social space within cities.
So essentially what you're saying is that it's the technology layered over old spaces that makes them new?
No, I'm saying that it's the way that people are using particular technologies that are actually producing new spaces.
And describe those new spaces.
Well, for example, one thing that's quite common is for people to maintain constant contact with a group of friends, close circle of friends, using text messaging. And through continuous messaging between this group, one effectively produces a kind of network between them, which is constant, continuous throughout the day. And so effectively what I'm suggesting is that one is occupying a kind of social space in this way.
I see. And how is that changing physical space?
Well, the impacts on physical space are less direct. What it's doing is, on some levels, changing the way we move through and interact with others in public space. For example, when one's walking down the sidewalk and two people are approaching you, one person is speaking on a mobile phone. If you're looking for directions to the subway, you probably won't ask the person speaking on the mobile phone for directions.
That's certainly true. Do you think that people, by being constantly distracted with technology, are missing something in terms of the physical space that cities offer?
Well, I think it's a question of what you mean by distraction. I mean, it's interesting, the relationship between attention and distraction. When we're speaking about distraction in that context, what we're really talking about is that their attention is directed elsewhere, away from the kind of immediate physical space they're moving through. And there's kind of a long history of people writing about the downfall, so to speak, of public space in that regard, the public citizen, so to speak. Richard Sennett is one. His The Fall of Public Man. Hannah Arendt speaks about public space as that space where we encounter difference, where we encounter the other. So I think, yes, to a large degree, these types of interactions we're having with and through technology do, to a certain extent, take away from our experiences with a kind of direct, immediate experience of public space.
It's true, too, that it creates this sort of blanket of familiarity, doesn't it, when you're always in touch with friends and family?
Yeah, Michael Bull is a professor at the University of Sussex, and he's written this book titled Personal Stereos in the Management of Everyday Life. And so he's writing about the Sony Walkman and the iPod and talking about ways that people use these devices to a certain extent, mitigate the contingencies of everyday life. So how we, for instance, manage our time on the bus, on the subway, through these devices becomes, in a way, it's an attempt to sort of create something of ourselves within an otherwise frictious public space.
It seems to me, and you tell me if you see it differently, Mark, but it seems to me very different if I am listening to an iPod versus talking on a phone or text messaging with someone. It's hard for me to think about why listening to an iPod is really anything fundamentally different than reading a newspaper, let's say when I'm on the train, versus staying in touch with someone, you know, where I feel connected to a world, again, that's very familiar to me. Does music create that same familiarity?
Well, that's what Michael Bull suggests, and you know, he relates that back to some of Theodore Adorno's work on radio, this notion of we-ness and kind of connecting with not just one's own personal music library, which, you know, of course, on one level is very much about this production of familiarity within sort of otherwise unfamiliar spaces, but also just, you know, the notion that I'm not just listening to any song, but I'm actually listening to a song which is perhaps popular or will sort of aid in a certain kind of identity work that we go through. And so in this sense, I think it's a you know, a question of creating more familiarity within the city. So if you're listening to an iPod, to a certain extent, you're creating your own private soundtrack mm-hmm. to the city.
Well, now that we're talking about soundtracks, I want you to talk about the Tactical Sound Garden.
Okay, yes, the Tactical Sound Garden. Well, that's a project I started a few years ago. It was produced in collaboration with Fiona Murphy and a number of other people with in different capacities at different times. The Tactical Sound Garden is an open-sourced software platform for cultivating virtual sound gardens in urban public space. So using a Wi-Fi-enabled mobile device, whether it's a laptop or a PDA or a mobile phone, one is able to plant sounds or prune sounds that other people have planted in specific places in the city.
And you said that your idea for the sound garden, the Tactical Sound Garden, was inspired by urban public gardens. How so?
Well, community gardening, really. You know, less the notion of a public garden. You know, in part, the idea arises out of a little bit what we were talking about before in terms of this kind of retreat of this sort of urban citizen from public space. Community gardens are wonderful in the way that they're able to bring together people within a kind of quasi-public space and provide a framework within which one has a more social setting within which to interact with other people.
When you talk about planting and pruning a sound garden, this open source software that you've created for doing that, explain to me how it works.
Essentially, what we're doing is we're taking what's called location-aware services. You know, it's a kind of open API which enables you to determine the location of the device in physical space. And that information is fed to a 3D audio engine running on the device, which takes your position in physical space and maps it to a location within a virtual audio environment. So essentially what you have is a sort of virtual audio environment which gets then mapped back onto the coordinates of geographic space.
And so describe one of the installations that you've done.
Well, I just came back a few months ago from Zurich, where we were working with a group of sound artists, and the group contributed audio files, which they had produced. They're usually short audio files, maybe 20 seconds, 30 seconds, a minute. Then we went out into the space of the city and in different locations planted sounds and, you know, modified, pruned sounds that other people had planted.
How do people end up experiencing the space, Mark?
Well, again, you know, using, you know, they need to have either a mobile phone or a PDA or a laptop. And they then can, using the software, simply go out into the city with headphones in a similar way that you would be listening to your iPod, for example. But, you know, what's different is that here, as you're moving through the city, sounds are getting louder as you're approaching them, and they're fading out as you move further away from them. Anyone participating at the same time will hear the same sounds. So rather than a kind of personal audio space, one is actually encountering a kind of shared audio environment.
And in Zurich, the sound artist you were working with, can you describe the sorts of sounds that they produced and wanted to plant in Zurich?
Sure. Yeah, it's really kind of interesting. Actually, that's one of the things that becomes fascinating about doing a project which iterates in different places. You know, in Zurich, it was a range of sounds. Some were more ambient sounds. So, for instance, the sound of running water or the sound of paper crunching. Others were samples from popular film. There was a great Woody Allen sample, which someone included. Still others are original compositions or small loops that they've created.
Is there art in the, or is there method to the madness in placing sounds in particular places? I can imagine that in some places it perhaps a place would evoke for an artist a particular sound, or are these sounds generally made without a sense of where in the end they will be placed?
Generally, its sounds are not created specifically for particular locations. What seems to be the case is that more often people are taking sounds and finding places where these sounds would in some way either add or contribute or work against the dominant experience of a particular place.
Yeah, give me an example.
So, for example, there's one place which is this, you know, wonderful park in the middle of Zurich where, a couple of people were planting these, you know, really crazy samples from films, you know, popular film soundtracks. And so here you're sitting in front of, you know, kind of quiet, wonderful park in front of a fountain, for example, and you're getting this kind of collage of popular film.
And I'm curious, how does that differ? I mean, obviously it's communal. Obviously someone else has chosen these sounds to put in this particular place, but I'm trying to think how the experience is really fundamentally different than putting on your iPod headphones and listening to music that maybe somebody else mixed for you.
Well, what happens usually, what happens when somebody's pruning your sound, I think, is really where it becomes something else. In other words, say you've planted a sound in a particular location and you've set the interval by which that sound plays back to once every minute. And somebody else has come along and maybe the next day or even the next week and decided that, well, actually, I want to hear that sound more frequently, or I really don't like that sound very much, so I'm going to turn it pretty much all the way down, turn down the volume. You end up then getting a short message from this person. And what it does is it begins to sort of provoke a kind of connection between two people as mediated by the sound itself.
Do you feel like the artist? Do you feel like the orchestrator? Do you feel like just simply the platform provider? I mean, what role do you feel you play in an installation like the one in Zurich?
Well, as an artist, I'm interested in creating platforms, and these platforms, you know, engage the audience not as a kind of passive observer, but an active participant in the production of the work itself. And so in that regard, it's less about creating a composition per se for someone else to consume, but to actually engage people in the active cultivation of the sonic environments of the city.
And you are also an architect.
That's right.
When you think about the analogy to the work of an architect, even an architect of public places or landscape architect of a park, say, and all of a sudden there's layered onto this thing that I created, perhaps technology or sounds that I never intended. It was not the way I had, you know, it wasn't my vision, but all of a sudden people have layered this vision onto it. As an architect, is that something that you think most architects would be comfortable with?
I have a hard time speaking for most architects. What I can say is that Frank Lloyd Wright obviously is a good example of an architect we all are probably familiar with in this country. And he, for instance, would go back to the houses he built and designed. And the thing about Wright was that he was not only designing the physical space, but he was also arranging the furniture. And he would go back to these houses and, in fact, rearrange the furniture if people had, for instance, made a different arrangement which wasn't to his liking. So he was notorious for that. And to a certain degree, architects do have this reputation for being control freaks in that regard. At the same time, one can look to work that was happening in the 60s, late 60s, particularly in the UK. And there was a concerted effort to try to find ways that one was able to give over, as an architect, a certain degree of responsibility for shaping the experience of the places and spaces we are inhabiting. And so I'm very much interested in seeing how technology, contemporary technology, can in a way continue that project and to engage the public at large in the shaping of physical settings.
Visitors to Chicago's Millennium Park are, as you know, wildly enthusiastic about the Crown Fountain with Plenza's towers of the LED displays of faces. Do you imagine that that kind of technology is going to enter more public spaces?
Well, I think we're starting to see that, particularly in terms of the sort of urban screen, these large installations of video screens in urban spaces. I think Times Square obviously is overrun with them at the moment. But the question is really, to me, if this is going to proliferate, so to speak, this kind of urban informatic landscape where we're encountering signs or images of faces or what have you, then how do we begin to address it in ways which make it more than simply another way to communicate a message? Quite often, a kind of related type of work involves these so-called interactive architectures, where one will take a lobby space, for example, and using very simple machine vision algorithms, using a camera, for example, a surveillance camera, tracking the movements of people moving through the lobby, and based on their movements, making something happen in terms of the way the light or the sound is activated in the space. Now, I think that on a certain level, these types of interactive installations really aren't that much more interesting than an automatic door opener. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, your experience of that system or the situation, really, is one of that, well, okay, this system knows I'm here, or at least it knows something resembling a body is here. It doesn't even know much about me. I think developing truly responsive environments is something which involves kind of higher level of interaction, one which is not necessarily a closed loop, but is a more open loop in the sense that I'm able to contribute something to this space more than just being at a certain place at a certain time, but I'm actually able to add something, such as, for example, with the sound garden, the idea is that one is actually able to add their own sounds. And so, to the extent where these types of interactive architectures, so to speak, are something which are open to contributions from people more than just the kind of physical location of where they are, then I think we're actually moving in an interesting direction.
And beyond the sound garden that you produced, have you seen other things that excite you in this way?
Well, I think there's an architect in the UK. His name is Usman Haque. Produces a wonderful set of urban public projects. Recently, he produced one here in New York, down in Washington Square, and it involved inviting the community of the park at large to participate in a kind of barn raising. And this barn itself was a kind of abstract form, a structure, but it was produced through these kind of ubiquitous plastic bags that one gets no matter where you're purchasing something. You're always handed it in a little plastic bag. So the idea there was to try to kind of produce in an almost non-technological way, or at least a low technological way, a similar type of sort of responsive system. And I think in this sense, where these environments become constructionally interactive, in other words, where we're engaged in the actual construction of the environment, we're getting somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you think generally are the implications of mobile and pervasive computing on architecture and on urbanism?
Well, generally speaking, I think that we're on the one hand, becoming much better at sort of communicating, connecting, and organizing, orienting ourselves within the space of the city. And so I think to a certain extent, there are the traditional cues that architecture and urbanism have provided in terms of helping us locate, orient, our, and navigate through the city are to a large extent being taken over by these technologies today. At the same time, there is a question about the social space of cities. And, you know, we were talking about this a little bit before, and I think that's where we're seeing the biggest impact, you know, ways that new technologies are being deployed to or being used by people to create a kind of buffer around themselves and, you know, to sort of further isolate themselves from difference. You know, cities, particularly public spaces in cities, have always been the site of difference, you know, the space where you encounter friction, you encounter something you wouldn't normally expect. Louis Kahn once famously said cities were the place where, you know, a young person could come to and encounter something that they would want to spend the rest of their lives pursuing. So to the extent that, you know, mobile technologies are beginning to connect us not so much with difference, but connect us with things that are similar to what we already like, a sense of familiarity, I think something is being lost. And so I think it's really, you know, it's important to see how the way we can use, the way we can appropriate, and in some ways use technologies in ways that they weren't originally designed for, where they really become kind of creative and productive opportunities.
If you want to see a video on how the Tactical Soundgarden Toolkit works, you can find a video at tacticalsoundgarden.net. Mark, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Okay, thank you, Carol.
Mark Shepherd is assistant professor at the University of Buffalo.
Listen to this.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
and French railway station.
Sounds provided by participants of the Tactical Soundgarden in Zurich, organized by Monja Pletsch and Martin Feutz. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. This week, City View's commentator Walker Smith takes a look at the greater good.
I haven't seen my doctor in years. Not that I haven't been to the doctor. I visit his office on a regular schedule. He's just never there anymore. I used to see him on every visit, but that was before he got heavily involved with other research and professional activities. Now he jets around the country for speeches, meetings, and consulting, and I never see him. I still go to his office, though, because even without him there, that's the best place for me. I see someone on his staff instead, and that's okay. The nurses and other doctors are great. They're smart, knowledgeable, attentive, and helpful. They've been trained by him. So they provide a level of care that reflects his skills and experience. It used to bother me that I never see him anymore. But now I realize that what I need is not so much him per se as his expertise. I need what he knows applied to my situation, however I can get it. Clearly, he's at the heart and soul of this. But his physical presence is not always required in order for me to get the care I need. This has been a lesson for me. My importance and value do not lie with me, but with what I know. The challenge for me is to figure out how to get what I know to make an impact on what I'm responsible for, and oftentimes that means doing so without me. I suppose this is pretty obvious to many of you, but I've had to learn it. As my wife might put it, I've had to learn to get over myself. Indeed, this is the model of our educational system. We train ourselves in what others know, thereby applying their expertise to the benefit of all, even though these experts are not physically present. Unfortunately, though, we have a tendency to glorify the person more than their expertise. We live in a personality culture that idolizes and rewards people who do things themselves. We don't bestow the same regard or benefits on people who go beyond themselves to make what they know and do best available in ways that exceed what they can physically accomplish. Yet it is expertise that really matters most. This is not to say that some of those who command our attention and fascination are not doing things that extend and stretch their expertise. It is only to say that we focus on the person, not on what he or she is doing to have a bigger impact on other people's lives. This has the regrettable effect of rewarding selfishness over selflessness and celebrity over legacy. It becomes a vicious cycle of feedback and reward that perpetuates a focus on taking for oneself rather than giving to others. And it worsens the task of preparing for the future because the only value that's rewarded is what happens today, not what's made available for future generations. What's most valuable is not any one of us. What makes the biggest contribution is what we do to go beyond ourselves, to transform the gifts and opportunities with which we are blessed into gifts and opportunities for others. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta, and his new book is Generation Ageless. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.